Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreenewspodcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
Unmissable stories from around the globe from the BBC World Service.
My happy place. This is who I am.
Search for the documentary Lives Less Ordinary and Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 24th of December, these are our main stories. The UN Special Envoy to Yemen says the warring parties have agreed to work towards a nationwide ceasefire. Israel says it's interrogating hundreds of suspected Hamas and Islamic Jihad operatives who've been captured in Gaza. An anti-war candidate who hoped to challenge Vladimir Putin in Russia's presidential election next year has been denied registration. Also in this podcast,
the various populations had acquired genetic differences through being separated by thick ice.
Scientists in Australia have raised new fears about the collapse of Antarctica's huge western ice sheet. A surprising animal study has helped them to draw such conclusions. Hundreds of thousands of people have died in 9 years of fighting between different factions in Yemen in a civil war which has drawn in neighbouring states and further sharpened tensions between them. The war has also spilled over into attacks on shipping in the Red Sea, through which much of the world's oil travels. We'll be hearing from India in a moment about a similar attack off its shores. But the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg, on Saturday announced that both sides, the Houthis in the north and the Saudi-backed government, have committed to steps towards a ceasefire. The language is cautious and diplomatic, but it could open the way to transform life for Yemenis, 80% of whom depend on humanitarian aid. I've been speaking to the journalist and Yemen expert Iona Craig.
It is an important moment for a couple of aspects. There had already been a ceasefire agreed in March 2022, but they hadn't renewed it when it expired in October of last year. So it would renew that. But there's also other details that the UN has revealed as part of this apparent agreement, which have been sticking points along the road since then. And that's about paying public sector salaries, the resumption of oil exports by the internationally recognised government, which the Houthis had prevented before by carrying out drone strikes on oil tankers, opening up of the roads, and that includes around the city of Tyres, which has been besieged by the Houthis, unbelievably, since 2015, and easing other restrictions on Sana'a Airport that the Houthis control and the port of Hodeida, which the Houthis also control. So, yes, I mean, it's progress, but some of this is a little bit of a rehash of what was agreed in 2022 but was never implemented.
Of course, the Iran-backed Houthis have been attacking, as you say, shipping in the Red Sea off Yemen's coast, and that has prompted the United States and others to make an international task force to keep that shipping safe. How does that play into this?
Well, Saudi Arabia has actually been behind the scenes quietly asking the US not to attack the Houthis directly, so not to carry out offensive measures in response to these attacks by the Houthis in the Red Sea, because they had a deal lined up with the Houthis, really outside of the UN mechanism, the UN Special Envoy's office, that was due to be signed back in October.
Then, of course, Gaza happened.
Yes, the Hamas attack happened, and the Saudis are extremely keen to extract themselves from this conflict. So I suppose, really, by having this moment now, the UN Special Envoy said that this deal is now happening, is that if there are offensive measures by the US or others with navies now taking part in the protection of vessels in the Red Sea, if they do decide to attack the Houthis directly, then this could put all of this in jeopardy.
You're one of the few Western journalists who've reported regularly from Yemen. You know the country well. Do you think this is going to happen?
Do I think this deal's going to go ahead? I mean, Honestly, I think with the Houthis, you have to take it with a huge amount of scepticism. As I said before, they haven't kept to deals in the past. The Houthis' word is not always their bond and definitely hasn't been. And as I say, some of these measures put forward by the UN Special Envoy today in this deal have already been put forward before and the Houthis haven't stuck to them.
Journalist and Yemen expert Iona Craig. I mentioned that drone attack off the coast of India a moment ago. The target was described as an Israel-affiliated ship sailing under a Liberian flag. It had been on its way from Saudi Arabia to India. I got more details from Anbarasan Etirajan in Delhi.
This attack set to happen about 200 nautical miles off the coast of Gujarat state in western India. Now, the attack sparked a fire on board the ship, which was put out. But according to the officials, none of the roughly 20 crew members were harmed. What is surprising is this incident happened not far from the Indian coast. That means it's from Yemen. It is about 2,000 kilometers approximately away from Yemen. That's where, in the Red Sea, as you mentioned, many of the attacks on ships were being carried out by Houthi rebels. And according to the U.S., more than 10 vessels have been attacked in such a fashion by these rebels because of the ongoing war in Gaza. So there are suspicions that it could be someone from Iran or from the region, but there has been no claim, or no one has admitted responsibility for the attack. It also shows what kind of dangers these commercial ships face.
India must be really worried about this.
It must be of concern to India because India is among the largest buyer of petrochemical products. So they really depend on these supplies. If these attacks increase, that could create a trouble for India. But what is interesting is, as I was mentioning, this was happening far away from the Red Sea, more than 2,000 kilometers away from the Red Sea. So it is also a warning sign for many of these merchant navy ships. You may know in the merchant vessels, there are thousands of Indians and Filipinos. They're working mainly in these industry. So that is another concern for the government here, because if the Indian citizens are injured or anything happens to them, that will be a big warning sign for the Indian government as well.
Anbarasan Etirajan in Delhi. Israel says it's questioning hundreds of suspected Hamas and Islamic Jihad operatives after transferring them from Gaza to Israel. The military said some of the men had been hiding among the civilian population. Israel's bombardment of Gaza is continuing relentlessly. In Khan Yunis, around 50 people are reported to have been killed over the past 24 hours. Residents in Jabalia refugee camp in the north of the territory have reported persistent aerial bombardment and shelling throughout Saturday. The deputy director of the UN World Food Programme, Carl Scow, says half of the people of Gaza are starving.
Something drastic needs to change. If we continue with the current situation, famine will happen in the next few weeks. 4 out of 5 of the hungriest people in the world right now are in Gaza, and that, given the situations we already have in the Sahel, in the DRC, in the Horn of Africa, in Afghanistan. So I think that tells you that this is a very dramatic and serious situation.
Mark Regev, who is a senior advisor to the Israeli Prime Minister, acknowledged what he called terrible suffering in Gaza, but told the BBC this was because the territory's Hamas leadership didn't give a hoot for the people there. He said Hamas had no intention of ending its fight against Israel.
People who call for an immediate ceasefire, what are they ultimately saying? They're saying Israel has to make cease its operation against Hamas, and Hamas stays in power in Gaza. That's the bottom line. Mm. If Hamas stays in power, that just condemns us all to more bloodshed in the future, because Hamas openly says it does not believe in peace with Israel. It believes in, Hamas's words, permanent war.
Our correspondent Shaima Khalil followed Saturday's developments in Gaza. I asked her first about the arrests made by the Israeli forces.
The Israeli statement said that some of those suspects had been hiding among the civilian population and some of them had surrendered voluntarily. And we've heard repeatedly from the Israeli army about the fact that Hamas militants have been hiding among civilian population. That's been their consistent claim. And this is what we've heard about some of the people who've been arrested. All in all, Israel says that 700 Palestinian militants have been arrested since the beginning of the war, 200 of them in this past week.
We heard that clip a few moments ago from the deputy director of the World Food Programme saying half of the people in Gaza are starving. The situation on the ground is just getting worse, isn't it?
It is getting worse. And I think the strong wording keeps coming from the United Nations. You know, the word famine has been used quite a lot this week. The fact that many World Food Programme officials have said Gaza is looking at a serious prospect of famine, that no one is safe from starvation in Gaza. And it just shows you the acute and urgent need of aid, not just to be delivered, but also to be distributed properly in Gaza. Because remember, with the geography, the difficult geography of Gaza, even though it's such a small place, is that it normally is very densely populated. A lot of this population has been displaced down south. So with the little aid that's coming in, either from Rafah or Kerem Shalom in the south, it's challenging at the best of times to distribute it among the population there. Spare a thought for those still holed up in the north. That aid has got a long and treacherous journey to get to those who need it the most. And that's just not happening because of the relentless bombardment.
And Shaima, you're in Bethlehem in the West Bank, normally quite a special place to be at this time of the year, but I imagine rather different at the moment.
Very, very different. Someone told me that Bethlehem is a shadow of itself. And you could feel the heaviness, really. You could feel that the war in Gaza is weighing heavily on this holy place. Normally, it would attract hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of pilgrims, of tourists at this time of year. You know, Manger Square is just, it's empty. And I think the heaviness also comes from the absence of this huge Christmas tree, the absence of Christmas carols, the absence of joy, and of course, the absence of peace because of what's happening in Gaza. And many have said that it feels very, very strange to have it like this, but it feels difficult to celebrate with the deaths and the killing that is happening in Gaza.
Shaima Khalil. The situation in Gaza is being watched closely across the region, most of all by other Palestinians. The vast majority of Gazans are refugees from the 1948 Arab-Israeli War or their descendants. Millions of Palestinians are scattered across the Middle East and beyond. About 500,000 are registered in Lebanon, many of them displaced in the wars of 48 and 1967. Decades later, they're still struggling to settle. And for many, the war in Gaza is both a traumatic flashback and a worrying development for the future. The BBC's Lina Sinjab has been to the Shatila refugee camp south of Beirut.
Our house was on a hill. It was very beautiful, built of stones.
Dawood Nasser is originally from Nazareth. He arrived in Lebanon with his family in 1948 when he was six.
We walked from Palestine to Bint Jabal.
Dawood's family members now live in Lebanon, Europe and Gaza, where one of his sons is. His son's house was destroyed at the start of the war, and he's now displaced in southern Gaza. He goes through his phone to show me photos of his grandchildren there. This latest war has reopened old wounds and has pushed him to the extreme.
If you look at Hiroshima, it is not as bad as what they did in Gaza. They want to exterminate all Palestinians, not only Hamas. The bloodshed has been going on since 1948.
The Israeli Defense Forces say they're trying to minimize civilian casualties in Gaza. But here, many share Dawood's views. The death toll in Gaza, especially among children, has caused a lot of anger and has reminded them of the past.
With the refugee problem of Hitler's Europe still an unhappy and recent memory, another of the same kind has been building up in Palestine.
Thousands of refugees arrived here in Lebanon in 1948. Up until May that year, Britain had governed Palestine under a UN mandate on a promise to establish a national home there for Jewish people. In the war that followed Israel's declaration of statehood in May 1948, about 700,000 Palestinians were expelled or forced from their homes. Palestinians call this the Nakba, or catastrophe. Nowadays, thousands of Palestinians here are struggling to survive. Because of the sectarian divisions in Lebanon and the Palestinian involvement in the Lebanese civil war in the mid-70s, to this day, the Lebanese government does not recognize any rights to Palestinian refugees, not even property ownership. and poorly paid jobs are the only ones allowed for young people in this camp. The United Nations agency UNRWA has been providing help here for decades.
As you can see, the camps are 75 years after their displacement, substandard slum environments.
Dorothy Klaus heads the agency in Lebanon.
Security is very bad. Sanitation, water is always a problem, and UNRWA is struggling to provide these very basic services to the Palestine refugees that should be standing on their own feet 75 years later. So we do hope that the way forward will bring additional resources and also political solutions for Palestine refugees.
Unable to settle in their present home, most people here are still focused on the past and hopeless about the future.
Peace process is in need of two parts.
Dr. Mohammad Khatib runs a museum that collects personal belongings of refugees in Lebanon. In a glass cabinet are dozens of old home keys. People kept them in the hope of going back one day.
Netanyahu do not want a state of Palestine. So what we can do? We are in need of a partner that also he say okay to the peace.
Today, people in the camp have taken to the streets to express solidarity to people in Gaza. Kids as young as five are parading, waving the Palestinian flag. Generation after generation keeps Palestine in the hearts and minds.
That report by Lina Sinjab. Next, to the Czech Republic, a minute's silence was held on Saturday to remember the victims of a gunman who carried out the worst mass shooting in the country's history. 14 people were shot dead at a university in the centre of Prague on Thursday. The police believe the gunman was also responsible for the deaths of three other people over the past week. The president, Petr Pavel, described the pain and sorrow suffered by the whole of Czech society. Our correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, sent this report from Prague.
A nation paused today to remember the victims of an attack people here can't make sense of. Church bells rang out across the Czech Republic. At Prague Cathedral, some of the survivors joined the congregation. Students and teachers who'd barricaded themselves into classrooms as the gunman roamed corridors. We're told most of those he shot were female, but we have no idea of his motive. In the end, the 24-year-old, who's been described as a brilliant student, turned the gun on himself. The archbishop in Prague explained that one of the roses laid on the altar was for the gunman.
In sacrifice, we will bring one rose for each victim to the altar, and we will add another for the one who allowed evil to possess and manipulate him so much that he became the tool of horrendous deaths.
There are shrines outside universities all over the country, where there are still big questions about how so many were killed when police had known an armed man was heading for Charles University. The Interior Minister has defended the police response to us as swift and professional. For now, the focus here is on remembering those killed who should have been returning home to their families this week for Christmas.
Sarah Rainsford. Still to come.
This poem is actually going to be on a chip on the side of the Europa Clipper mission, and it is going to go on a 1.8 billion mile journey around this icy moon of Jupiter.
Do you want to get involved with this unique space mission? Find out later.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, owner and user of Mint Mobile with a special holiday message. If you sign up now for 3 months, you get 3 months free on every one of our plans, even unlimited. Now, I realize this is more of a holiday offer than it is a holiday message. But if you read between the lines, you can see a message in there. It says we love you. Visit mintmobile.com/switch for the offer.
Limited time new customer offer. Activate within 45 days. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. Unlimited customers using more than 40 gigabytes per month will experience lower speeds. Video streams at 480p. See mintmobile.com for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreenewspodcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
Something mysterious plagues County Mayo on the west coast of Ireland and its legendary Gaelic football team.
They've come to see the game of the year.
The year is 1951, and County Mayo have just won the sport's biggest prize. But in the midst of such elation, there's a funeral. And for the priest leading the congregation, this sacrilege must be punished. A curse exits his lips. Damnation be upon every one of you. It came to pass.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Just days after registering as a candidate for the presidential election in Russia next year, a former television journalist has been barred from standing. The disqualified candidate, Yekaterina Donskova, had been planning to run on a platform of opposition to the war in Ukraine. With most opposition figures in Russia either behind bars, like Alexei Navalny, or outside the country, President Putin seems almost certain to win a fifth term as head of state in March, cementing his decades-long grip on power. The Electoral Commission said Ms. Donskova was banned because of mistakes in her application. But what were they? A question for our reporter, Sasha Schlichter.
No, Alex, nobody's saying what mistakes. They just said there were violations of the procedure for registration. They could have come up with any excuse. What's more, nobody knows of Yekaterina Donskova. She's a former TV journalist. She doesn't represent any party, so she was going to run as an independent just to make a statement saying that I'm challenging Putin. I don't like his war. I don't like the fact that most of his opponents have been incarcerated. I'm against all this. And she just wanted to have the floor. And, of course, the Kremlin could have just let her do it. But we are now having another political climate in Russia, from the one that was before the war, during the previous election campaign. So no dissent will be brooked now. If you hear anybody now mildly criticizing the Kremlin, rest assured, this person would have been vetted by the Kremlin, because they need the appearance. They need the appearance of democracy. Putin wants to be elected, even if the election is rigged. You know what I mean? It's like, for this, he needs all the attributes of an election campaign, like opposition voices, to go on the campaign trail.
So it's going to be hard for the opposition to win this, but what is the state of the opposition?
There is no opposition. All the real critics are sitting behind bars. So Navalny is behind bars. We don't even know where he is. Supposedly he's been moved to another prison, but we don't know which one. They never told us. So there is this so-called opposition Communist Party, which has always been the official opposition. But everybody says, oh, it's like a vetted party. It's like, it always would get, like, if Putin would get, say, 80% of the vote, the communists would get 14, say. So this time is the same candidate, Kharitonov. He's already in his 70s. And he said, oh, no, I will not challenge Putin. He's his own man. I will just stand as a candidate. But they're all afraid even to challenge him, you know. And how do you challenge Putin? If you challenge Putin, you have to criticize the war. If you criticize the war, you make yourself liable to imprisonment. And then there's another party, like, for example, there's a party which is called a Just Russia for Truth party. And it said today that it would support Putin at the election. We don't know why.
Sasha Schlichter. Staying with matters Russian, Moscow said recently it will confiscate the income from frozen Western assets if the European Union acts on plans to take the profits from frozen Russian companies and hand these to Ukraine. The EU and US are looking into ways to tap into the $300 billion of Russia's state frozen assets, the bulk of which is held in Europe. This is after they failed to provide two crucial aid packages to Kyiv worth more than $100 billion earlier this month due to political disagreements. The Financial Times newspaper has reported that the US is lobbying G7 members to confiscate those assets altogether. International lawyers headed by Philip Zelikow, a former senior US diplomat, have set out a legal basis for transferring Russian sovereign reserves. He's been telling Sean Lay more.
Never before in world history has an aggressor carried out a gigantic aggression while leaving hundreds of billions of dollars and euros in the accounts of the law-abiding countries wounded by this aggression. That now creates a circumstance that allows those law-abiding countries, following international law, to use that money to compensate the victims of Russia's wrongful behavior. This would be done under the international law of state countermeasures. Countermeasures is, I'm going to violate the ordinary obligations I owe to you because of your prior outlaw behavior. That's a long accepted doctrine under international law. And it's been applied before, for example, when Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990, all of Iraq's assets in the West were frozen, and those assets were eventually transferred to compensate the victims of Iraq's aggression.
If this idea is not new, if it's been done before, why is there still resistance to it? The Americans are trying to persuade other G7 nations, at least, to agree to this. Why is there resistance?
There are several reasons. One, the sheer novelty of the scale of it. Yes, it's a large-scale move, but it's responding to a historic challenge, a generational challenge. The other part of the problem is there's nervousness among central bankers especially about not doing things that will discourage people from putting money in their currencies. That's why it's essential that all the main reserve currencies move together. So if dollar, euro, sterling, yen all move together, well, that's 93% of the foreign exchange holdings in the world. So it's very important that the action be multilateral. And this is a point that the European central bankers have stressed, that they don't want to go out there alone. A further objection is that some academics are concerned that this allows powerful states to use countermeasures, and they don't like that. They don't think anything should be done unless Russia has consented to it. But then the irony is that the powerful aggressor gets to wreck its weak victims, and then people are solicitous about the rights of the powerful aggressor. There is a final set of concerns that people don't talk about very much. There is a widespread fear of Russian retaliation against their companies and investments in Russia, especially. That would be unlawful. And Russia has already taken these companies hostage and has already confiscated the assets of several of them just to show they can. Those companies that Russia retaliates against will simply join the line of the victims of Russia's aggression, and they'll join the ranks of the claimants for compensation.
Philip Zelikow, a former senior U.S. diplomat. Next to the United States, and a woman from the state of Alabama who was born with two wombs and became pregnant in both has given birth to baby girls one day apart. Kelsey Hatcher, who's 32, described them as her miracle babies. Chantal Hartle reports.
The healthy delivery of the two girls named Roxy and Rebel has stunned doctors in Alabama. An estimated 3 in 1,000 women are born with the condition uterus didelphys, where a double uterus is formed, each with one fallopian tube and one ovary. Dr. Richard Davis, a fertility specialist at the University of Alabama Hospital, said he had never seen and is unlikely to see a case like this again.
A double cervix, a double uterus is way under 1%, maybe 3 per 1,000 women might have that. And then the probability of having a twin in each horn is really crazy.
Ms. Hatcher had 3 previous healthy pregnancies. This time she believed herself to be pregnant in only one uterus until a routine ultrasound revealed there was also a baby in her second. She recalls the moment she broke the news to her husband.
I said, well, there's 2 of them in there. He said, you're lying. I said, no, I'm not.
After a total of 20 hours in labour, Miss Hatcher gave birth to her daughters one day apart. Dr. Davis said he believed the two girls could be called fraternal twins because both were in one belly at the same time. As he put it, they just had different apartments.
Chantal Hartle. Scientists in Australia have raised new fears about the collapse of Antarctica's huge western ice sheet, and their research has come from a surprising source, octopuses. How? Terry Egan explains.
The researchers sequenced the DNA of nearly 100 turquoise octopuses from different areas around the Antarctic and divided them into separate populations. They then worked backwards to build various models to explain the different ways those octopuses had interbred, or not, over the centuries. The various populations had acquired genetic differences through being separated by thick ice. But the researchers found the octopuses resumed interbreeding around 100,000 years ago. That's when there was a warmer patch between ice ages. Temperatures were about half a degree warmer than now, and that, most likely, is when the western ice sheet collapsed, allowing the different populations to meet and interbreed. The finding chimes with the geological evidence. But that figure of half a degree raises alarm bells, because some projections suggest we're heading that way now, and that suggests the West Antarctic ice sheet could collapse again.
Terry Egan. Next year, a new NASA spacecraft, the Europa Clipper, will hurtle towards Jupiter with the intention of finding out whether there could be extraterrestrial life underneath one of its moons. The mission will carry more than just high-tech machinery. It will also have on board a poem by the US poet laureate Ada Limon in Praise of Mystery, a poem for Europa. Alongside the poem will be hundreds of thousands of people's names that have been submitted to NASA. Here's a short excerpt of the poem, read by Ada Limon.
Arching under the night sky, inky with black expansiveness, we point to the planets we know. We pin quick wishes on stars. From Earth we read the sky as if it is an unerring book of the universe, expert and evident.
The poem was requested for the space mission by the head of science for NASA, Dr. Nicola Fox.
This poem, written by Ada Limon, it is actually going to be on a chip on the side of the Europa Clipper mission, which will launch in October of next year. And it is going to go on a 1.8 billion mile journey out and around this icy moon of Jupiter. And we're hoping to find telltale signs that at some time life could have been supported. Anyone listening, you can send your name with us. You can have your name put on the Europa Clipper space craft. Google NASA message in a bottle and you can sign up. The opportunity does close on December 31st, so don't wait. If you want to join us on a 1.8 billion mile journey in our solar system, it's exciting.
And I've done it already. Dr. Nicola Fox from NASA. Of all the baffling activities that mark British life, pantomime, also known as panto, must rank pretty high. The theatrical extravaganza appears only at Christmas and features cross-dressing, terrible jokes, audience participation, fantastical costumes, singing and dancing, and a really limited repertoire of plots. Now, the British government is beginning a consultation to see whether it and other typically British traditions should be put forward for United Nations protected status. David Sillitoe reports.
The British government will next year sign up to UNESCO's Convention for Safeguarding Intangible Cultural Heritage, and it wants to know what people think should go on the list. The convention is a global catalogue of cultural activities that are highly regarded and in some cases in need of preservation. So should we be adding panto? Or cheese rolling? Or local crafts? France, Greece and Spain all have dry stone walling on their list. Should it be on ours? Belgium has traditional beer making. India, yoga. Argentina and Uruguay, tango. Are Morris dancing or the Highland Fling cultural treasures? The government would like to know.
David Sillitoe. And that's all from us for now. But before we go, let's hear about the Happy News review for 2023. Here's Jackie.
Yes, and I guarantee that there were more positive stories in 2023 than you think there were. So we will be reminding you. That jaw-dropping rescue from the dangling cable car in Pakistan, that's in. Also, good news for blue whales in the Seychelles, a new affordable malaria vaccine, the beautiful art still being uncovered in Pompeii, the kids who survived 40 days lost in the Colombian jungle, and the marvel that is Simone Biles, and much more, of course, all in the Global News Podcast 2023 Happy News Review. And yes, we probably should have thought of a snappier title. It's available on Monday, December the 25th on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Johnny Hall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreenewspodcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.